Support for NPR podcasts comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Whether you grew up in Temple or the Church of Rock and Roll or Reggae, you know the Bible's Book of Psalms. By the rivers of Babylon, sing a new song, out of the mouths of babes, the valley of the shadow of death. The Psalms are the song and poetry of the Bible, poetry of joy and sorrow and consolation that has burst out of the realm of faith to imbue an entire culture. Now the great scholar and literary translator Robert Alter brings a new version that goes back to the Psalms' oldest roots in Hebrew. Up next on Point, from the King James Version to the roots of the Psalms. Joining me today from Berkeley, California, is Robert Alter, professor of Hebrew and comparative literature at the University of California, Berkeley, and an acclaimed literary scholar and biblical translator. He's in the midst of a highly ambitious and innovative translation of the Hebrew Bible and has already completed the five books of Moses and the story of David. Nobel laureate poet Seamus Heaney called Robert Alter's translation of the books of Moses a godsend, immediately readable and immensely learned. His most recent effort comes with his The Book of Psalms, a translation with commentary. Robert Alter, thank you very much for being with us today.
I'm very happy to be here.
And a special treat, I also have with me, ready to, rock or worship or call it what you will when the time comes, cantor Rosalie Tobus from Temple Sinai in Brookline, Massachusetts. Cantor Tobus, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me here today.
Robert Alter, your new translation is all about letting us hear, to the extent that you can, the Hebrew breathing in the English, and Rosalie Tobus will help us hear that directly at a couple of points in this hour. But put in your own words what you were setting out to do when you waded back into this great book of the Bible.
Well, I would begin with the music of the poetry. Now, I don't mean the ancient melodies, which we know nothing about because there was no system of notation in the temple period. But I mean the music of the words, the rhythms, the repetition of sounds, the alliterations, and so forth. I find that even the finest translations, which I still think would be the King James Version, do not represent this music very well. In particular, there's a terrific compactness about the biblical language, which the poets exploit in wonderful ways. So a large part of my task as I worked with these poems line by line was first to introduce some kind of regular rhythm that would be at least subliminally available to the ear of the reader, and second, to tamp down the language, to make it much more compact than any of the previous translations.
We're going to be reading from the Psalms, King James and Robert Alter's version, in just a few minutes, but give us a brief history lesson, if you would, Robert Alter. When, where, how did the Psalms originate?
Well, it's a pretty good guess that most of them were composed in Jerusalem around the temple. They may well have been composed, not all of them, I think, but a good many of them, by priests or priestly scribes, because you can see that many of the poems are designed for use in the temple service. They were composed over a long period of time. Probably the oldest would go back to perhaps even as far as 1000 before the Common Era. The latest might take us down to the 400s BCE. And so it's really not a unified book by a single author, but an anthology, and an anthology that spans 500, perhaps even 600 years.
You write that these were very much an expression of obviously the language and culture of that time, and that drew in no small part from neighboring languages, cultures, history, even pagan history of celebratory and religious song and poetry.
Yes, I think this is a really important thing for us to see about Psalms. Biblical scholars for a long time, since modern archaeology, I think, have recognized that there are all kinds of interconnections between the literature of the Bible and the surrounding cultures. And we can assume that the biblical poets and the biblical prose writers were highly learned literary intellectuals, that they probably read other languages. They certainly read Canaanite, which would have been very close to Hebrew. They probably read Akkadian. Some of them might have read Egyptian. And like poets everywhere, the way T.S. Eliot drew on French poetry of the late 19th century, for example, they tapped different sources. And what really struck me working on the poems was how much of Canaanite mythology, most of it, I think, rather rigorously turned into a monotheistic worldview, but how much of this mythology survives in these poems.
In particular, you're looking at the Canaanite mythology recurring frequently in the Psalms, this kind of cosmogonic conquest of a monstrous sea god, suggesting chaos, by a warrior god associated with order, given a monotheistic outlook, but you've got various names of that sea monster, Leviathan and Rahab and Yam and Tanit, conquered by God. They're here, though you say the sea gods gets kind of demoted in the Psalms, even demoted to aquatic pets with which the Lord of these Psalms can play.
Yes, in Psalm 104, which is one of my favorite, it's a stunning poem that is a panoramic vision of the harmonious creation that God has established. We have Leviathan splashing around in the water alongside ships, and God evidently playing with him. In other poems, we have more of a survival of a sense of a scary monster of tremendous power, whose power nevertheless does not avail against the overwhelming power of the God of Israel. And in a third group of poems, this cosmogonic myth has been naturalized, I would say, where we have God being more powerful, mightier than the mighty breakers of the sea. Now, in those poems, you don't see a monster, but you have a kind of ghostly reminiscence of the conquest of the monster, but now transposed into the idea that the surging power of the sea is subdued by God.
Such beautiful language here, so beautiful that name your language, whether Hebrew or in its English translations, it's crept out into so much of the wider culture. How would you describe the range of emotions and purposes in the Psalms?
Well, it's a pretty wide range. That is, the Hebrew title for this book, Tehillim, actually does not mean psalms. It means praises. Mm-hmm. That is obviously a function of a good many of the poems. That is, they're praises of God. And, of course, the Hebrew word hallelujah that has entered into probably all the Western languages means literally praise God. Mm-hmm. There are those celebrations of God's greatness. Then there are the supplications in which a person in some terrible crisis, beset by enemies, plagued by a life-threatening illness, wrestling with some dark night of the soul.
Help me, Lord.
Help me, Lord, exactly. And then there are poems that are reflections on the human condition, on the brevity of our lives over against eternity. And it goes on. There are many other functions.
Robert Alter, we'll go to the 23rd Psalm, the famous Valley of the Shadow of Death, in just a moment. But take us first, if we can do a little compare and contrast here, to Psalm 114, if you'd be good enough. I think Cantor Tobias is prepared to chant a bit of this for us in a moment. But first, I'd like to just compare, if you could give us a sense of maybe the King James Version and then yours, to give a sense of how you're turning the language here toward the Hebrew.
Okay, do you want me to do this with Psalm 114?
If you'd be good enough, let's start there. We'll get to the 23rd in a moment.
Okay, absolutely. So first, I will read the very familiar King James Version of Psalm 114, which sounds like this. When Israel went out of Egypt, the house of Jacob, from a people of strange language, Judah was his sanctuary, and Israel his dominion. The sea saw it and fled. Jordan was driven back. The mountains skipped like rams, and the little hills like lambs. What ailed thee, O thou sea, that thou fleddest, thou Jordan, that thou wast driven back? Ye mountains, that ye skipped like rams, and ye little hills like lambs, tremble, thou earth, at the presence of the Lord, at the presence of the God of Jacob, which turned the rock into standing water, the flint into a fountain of waters.
So there's the King James Version, and now you've come with a new ear and eye for this, closer to the Hebrew, in your Book of Psalms.
Right. Now, I must say that the King James Version varies from psalm to psalm. I rather like their version of the 114th better than I do some others. And a few lines will be fairly close, but then there are significant differences, and maybe I'll just comment on one or two of them after I read my version.
Mm-hmm.
When Israel came out of Egypt, the house of Jacob from a barbarous-tongued folk, Judah became his sanctuary, Israel his dominion. The sea saw and fled, Jordan turned back. The mountains danced like rams, hills like lambs of the flock. What is wrong with you, sea, that you flee, Jordan, that you turn back? Mountains, that you dance like rams, hills like lambs of the flock? Before the Master, whirl, O earth, before the God of Jacob, who turns the rock to a pond of water, flint to a spring of water. Now, the two things that I would observe is, at the beginning, the King James Version has a people of strange language, and I made a point, I thought it needed more punch. Amlo is in Hebrew, I represented as a barbarous-tongued folk. You know, that word that we get from the Greek, barbarous, means any people that speaks an unintelligible language that sounds like bur, 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 bur.
And that is opposed to people of strange language. So you've got a little more punch here in your translation.
Exactly. And one other small point, because I hope listeners could hear that rhythmically, even in this psalm, my version is more compact, uses more monosyllabic words and fewer words than the King James Version. Toward the end, we have tremble thou earth at the presence of the Lord in the King James Version. And in my version, it's before the Master, whirl, O earth.
Wow.
Now the Hebrew word means both to tremble. It's associated with the convulsions of childbirth, but it also means to dance. Mm. So I settled on whirl as an English word that might somewhat straddle those two meanings.
We've got rams dancing and the earth itself whirling here. We're fortunate to have Cantor Tobias with us. Rosalie Tobias, if you'd be good enough, we'd love to just hear some of this as you, maybe the first few verses, as you would deliver them, to hear that rhythm, that sound of the Hebrew itself.
This version is composed by Yedidia Admon, an early 20th century mid-20th century Israeli composer, and we hear it most often at festivals such as Passover. Bet Seit Yisrael mi Mitzrayim, Beit Yaakov me'am lo'ez, Haita Yehuda le'kodsho, Yisrael mamshelotav, Hayom ra'yav ayanos, Hayorden yisov le'achor, Harim rakedu chelim, givot kivnetzon, betzeit Yisrael mi Mitzrayim, beit Yaakov me'am lo'ez.
Canto Rosalie Tobis with the 114th Psalm. Robert Alter is here. He has a new translation, taking it from the King James and much that comes after to something closer to the compactness of Hebrew. We'd love to hear your favorite psalm. Maybe we can hear it read or a bit of it. Compare and contrast. We've got a lot of listeners calling Robert Alter, Cantor Tobis. Bernadette is calling from Malone in New York. Hi, Bernadette. You're on the air.
Hello. I'm 76 years old, and most of my life I've been meditating on, reciting, singing psalms. But, you know, I assumed that they were all written by young David as he was on the hillside with his sheep and with his lyre, and he composed these.
It's a great image.
Yes, that's what I guess it must have just been taught to children, but I assumed it all of my life. And of course, this is probably one of my favorite parts of the Bible.
Bernadette, we'll come to the question of David, but what is it about the Psalms that has had you meditating on them and reciting them yourself?
Oh, well, the poetry, and they strike right to the heart and the soul of all mankind. They answer all of the questions of life.
It is beautiful indeed.
That they don't answer, and they give wonderful peace and of mind.
Amen to that, Bernadette. Thank you. And Robert Alter, what about this question? I mean, many people look to David or Solomon or both and say, isn't that where the Psalms came from? Where does that understanding come from? And you have references to David throughout your translation.
Right, because it's there in the Hebrew text, but the references to David, with three or four exceptions, are not part of the body of any of the poems, but they're a little line at the top of the poem that scholars call a superscription. Mm. And these were added by editors maybe in the 4th century before the Christian era. Now, it was very common in that period, in the late biblical period, to ascribe a text to an important figure from earlier history in order to give some kind of prestige to the text. And I'm not even sure if the audiences at the time literally believed that the ascription was what it said, that the author was somebody who had lived 500 years earlier. But the same thing with the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. Mm. But actually, the Hebrew in which it's composed was a Hebrew that had evolved several hundred years later than Solomon. It's a very late book. So all biblical scholars agree that these are not written by David. Maybe there might be it's not inconceivable, a couple of poems in here which are actually composed by David, but in fact, many of them refer to historical events which are much later than David, and some of them show language which couldn't have been the language of David's era around 1000 BCE, because biblical Hebrew, like any language, changes through time.
We've talked about language, and we'll speak of that more. There's also issues of attitude and worldview that you address in your translation. Maybe a way to begin to step into that would be to look at one of the most famous of all psalms, the 23rd Psalm. I mean, you know, I was raised very much in the church. The psalms are very much part of life, and this one always around. particularly in a family raising sheep, this was very popular. But I wonder if we might go through this. I wonder, Robert Alter, if I might read the King James version.
Absolutely.
And you could follow with your new translation verse by verse here, and so we can compare more easily. Shall we dive in?
Sure.
I'll read the King James, and Robert Alter will follow with his brand new translation. So there's a familiar words. Let's go. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want.
Now, let me say this one, I pondered, should I change it? I said, no, it's perfectly accurate and it's proverbial. So I said, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want.
All right, entirely familiar. Then we began to come in new directions. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. One of the most famous verses in the Bible.
In grass meadows he makes me lie down. By quiet waters guides me.
All right. I can hear people in love with King James saying, wait a minute, I love that music of, you know, he maketh me to lie down in green pastures. What is it that took you in this new direction? In grass meadows he makes me lie down. By quiet waters guides me.
Well, the Hebrew doesn't say green. It says grass, and I thought I should stick with the Hebrew. And it's probably meadows rather than pastures, although that's a judgment call. What I tried to do was to get rid of all those extra syllables. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures, and said, in grass meadows he makes me lie down, by quiet waters guides me.
This closer to the compactness of the Hebrew. And then we come to a verse where some of the maybe theological divergence begins to emerge. Here in the King James Version, 23rd Psalm, he restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. And yours?
My life he brings back. He leads me on pathways of justice for his name's sake.
King James says soul. You say life.
Right.
There's a difference.
Yeah, this is a crucial point of vocabulary in Psalms. The Hebrew Bible has no notion of a split between body and soul. The word that came to be translated as soul, and this was influenced by the old Latin version, which has anima, actually means life, breath, and by extension, life, and in certain contexts, it can even mean something like neck or throat, because that's the passageway through which the breath comes from outside into the lungs. And I think that what the poet is talking about is not a moment of spiritual transformation, not that this isn't a spiritual poem, but he's talking about God's sustaining and reviving his life.
More concrete, more directly in the midst of life, without the body-soul divide there that King James brings on. Let's plunge on. King James, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me.
Though I walk in the vale of death's shadow, I fear no harm, for you are with me, your rod and your staff, it is they that console me.
The Valley of the Shadow of Death, so famous, yeah. Straight out of King James.
Right.
1601, a real golden age of the English language. In English, you know, it's sure got a lot of loyalty, that passage, but you go to the Vale of Death's Shadow.
Now, I have to say that a dear friend of mine who's a fine reader of poetry, when he saw the draft, said, hey, wait a minute, you just did that to be different. I
Contrarian.
Said, no, no. And then I explained to him what I'll explain to your listeners. Mm. The Hebrew for that half line sounds simply like this. Ach ki elech begei tzalmavet. And from that, you get it in the King James Version, yea, though I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, which is about three times as many syllables and three times as many words. It's beautiful. I am not dissing the King James Version.
Right.
And it is made a profound effect on much of literary English ever since the 17th century, right down to Cormac McCarthy. But the problem is that if you read this as poetry, and the rhythm is pretty loose, I would say, it's the kind of poetic line that you would find in Walt Whitman. You know, those long, sprawling lines that go on.
Not in Hebrew.
Practically to the margin. And that's not what ancient Hebrew poetry is like, so that's why I did.
Let's go to this next one. King James, "Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over." And yours?
"You set out a table before me in the face of my foes. You moisten my head with oil. My cup overflows."
The final verse, King James, "Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." And again, yours?
"Let but goodness and kindness pursue me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord for many long days." Okay, I'll very quickly say the two. One has to do with accuracy. The other has to do with worldview. Not anointed my head with oil, but moistened my head. That is, there's a very good Hebrew verb for anoint. It's related to the same root as Messiah, Mashiach in Hebrew. But that's not the word that's used here. The word that's used means to make something feel luxuriant. In fact, in a draft, I had "you pleasure my head with oil," but my wife, who has better judgment than I, said, no, that's too sexy.
Right.
So I opted for moisten. But the point is that it's not some kind of divine crowning. It's making the speaker feel good, because the ancient Hebrews, like the ancient Greeks, rubbed themselves with oil the way we rub ourselves with body lotion.
Cantor Tobias, we'd love to just hear some of that 23rd Psalm, if you could share it with us again in the Hebrew, as it might be offered in your temple.
Psalm 23, most often heard in a Yizkor memorial service, such as on Yom Kippur. Coming right up, and other festivals as well, and of course in the funeral liturgy. Mm-hmm. The composer of this is B.Z. Schenker.
Mizmor LeDavid, Adonai Roi Lechzar, Mi'eno Deshei Arbitzeini, Almei Menuchot Yenahaleini. Gam Ki Eilech Meget Salmavet Lo Irara Ki Atai Madi Shivtecha Umishante Shantecha, Emayen Nachamuni.
Cantor Rosalie Tobias. Robert Alter, as you say, we don't know exactly how these psalms would have been sung or recited in the even Bronze Age era of their creation. But does that sound, which will be familiar to Jews from temple, does that play in your ear as you go about your work of translation, what we're hearing from Cantor Tobias, or something else?
Well, I don't think that I, of course, have heard a lot of melodies for psalms in synagogue, and then I've heard others on CDs, like there are some wonderful settings to the psalms done in the 16th century in Italy by a composer named Salomone di Rossi, that is settings to the Hebrew psalms. But I don't really listen to that when I'm reading the psalms, and especially reading them to translate. What I listen to is the intrinsic music, that's the poetic music of the Hebrew language.
Let's turn to our listeners, if I may, in Flagstaff, Arizona. Andrew is calling. Hi, Andrew, you're on the air.
Hi, good to speak with you. I take issue with one of your earlier word choices when you decided that barbarian was a good choice for a foreign tongue. And while I agree with you that etymologically it's a neutral word, did it occur to you while you were translating this that in most common English that's got a fairly pejorative sense to it? And also, I was curious as to what motivated you to continually use the passive voice instead of the active voice while writing some of these translations.
Great question. Stick with us, Andrew. What do you say, Robert Alter?
Well, as far as the second one, I don't think that it's accurate, so I'll just put that.
Well, you don't think you use the passive voice more than the King James actor?
No, I really don't think I did.
Okay.
Now, as far as my translation did not say barbarian. Now, to call somebody a barbarian is, as the listener says, an insult. What I said was a barbarous-tongued folk, where the barbarous is a little bit different from barbarian.
But isn't barbarous still more of an epithet or pejorative than strange?
Yes, it is. And it refers to the language. Mm-hmm. And here is an idea that actually comes back in maybe five or six different Psalms, that the terror and the anguish of the enslavement in Egypt mm-hmm. was compounded by the fact that the taskmasters, the enslavers, spoke an unintelligible language, a language that from mm-hmm. the point of view of the Hebrews was somehow beyond the pale. And that's why I think that it was the right choice to say barbarous-tongued.
Andrew, can you not imagine that Hebrew people who had been enslaved might have heard that tongue as barbarous? Maybe that extra spin, that pejorative quality is appropriate.
If they lived in a bilingual society, I don't think the onus was any harder than Mexican workers having to work with people who speak English. It seems to me like a word like alien, while it may not seem as floral a word, mm-hmm. Seems to get the message across a little bit better. And I think when you're saying that there's an important difference between barbarous and barbarian, from a grammarian's point of view, I can see what you're saying. But again, you're not speaking to grammarians. You're speaking to an average audience of people who don't get that connotation.
Yeah, we see the difference in perspective right there. And Andrew, thank you very much for your call. Robert Alter, may I take another from Bethany,
yes, please.
Connecticut. Larry, you're on the air with Robert Alter.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think Professor Alter said that there were a couple different kinds of psalms, and one of which is, to paraphrase it, kind of, I'm in deep trouble, what do I do now?
Right,
and,
yeah.
And my favorite of those, and meant a lot to me over the years, is Psalm 121. Which mm-hmm. is, I lift up my eyes to the heavens, to the hills, from where
right.
did my help come?
It's a beautiful psalm, it is.
And my question is the Hebrew as powerful as the English?
Oh, I think you have to assume for any kind of great poetry that the original is always more powerful than the translation, as fine as the translation might be. And I can assure you that the Hebrew is very moving, very eloquent. And that's a poem where the language is extremely simple. And much of the eloquence comes from the sheer simplicity of the language.
Let's hear it, if we may,
yes.
Robert Alter. This is Psalm 121. Let's go back and forth again, if we may, just so that we can feel the difference. This is the very famous, as Larry says, it begins in the King James Version, I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh my help. Do you have yours there?
Okay. Do you want to read the whole in the King James Version?
Well, I mean, just to look at the first couple. In the next verse, my help cometh from the Lord, which made heaven and earth. Perhaps you can take us into the texture of your translation.
Okay. A song of ascents. I lift up my eyes to the mountains. From where will my help come? My help is from the Lord, maker of heaven and earth. He does not let your foot stumble. Your guard does not slumber. Look, he does not slumber, nor does he sleep, Israel's guard. The Lord is your God and the guard, and the Lord is your shade at your right hand. By day the sun does not strike you, nor the moon by night. The Lord guards you from all harm. He guards your life. The Lord guards your going and your coming now and forevermore.
And now, they're interestingly, in the next to the last verse, of course, the King James is not guarding you from harm and guarding your life. It is, the Lord shall preserve thee from all evil. He shall preserve thy soul. So there again, that kind of, is that an intentional, translational lean toward a Christian perspective in the King James?
It might well be. I suspect that it is. Now, there's one other feature which doesn't have to do with theology, but I think does have to do with the kind of eloquence you have in the poem. There's one word which, or let's say a verbal root, which is repeated in the Hebrew about 8 or 9 times, either as a verb or as a noun, and that's the word guard. And I kept that all the way through because I thought that the power of the poem came partly from this insistent repetition on guard, guarding, guard. And if you look at the King James Version, you know, first you have keeper and then you have preserve. And I think it dilutes the strength of the poem.
A caller said this is one he turns to, you know, for with a sense when he needs help. You point to the difference, and it's not exactly in this verse, but throughout. Very often where the King James Version uses, it has the singer looking for salvation, you render that as rescue. And I wish you'd speak to that interesting distinction, difference.
Well, as we know, salvation is a very fraught theological term. To my mind, it calls up things like those wonderful panoramic pictures of the Last Judgment with those who have been vouchsafed salvation sitting at the right hand of God. Now, the Hebrew definitely means something like to get somebody out of a tight fix. That's what the verb, which is associated with the noun Yeshua, means.
Also associated with the Hebrew for Jesus.
Right. Jesus' name comes from that. Now, to be perfectly honest about this, in post-biblical Hebrew, in the Hebrew of the early rabbis, this same noun Yeshua comes to mean something close to Christian salvation, or at least messianic redemption, so something like that. Mm-hmm. But again and again in the Bible, it's, for example, if you're in a battle and your enemy is about to do you in and then you're saved, that is Yeshua. So that's why I call it rescue.
A little more earthly, a little less heavenly.
Right.
Let's go to a call from Sam in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a simple question, but maybe it's a tough answer. I'm just wondering, you mentioned that the melodies were not known because they weren't transcribed. I understand that in those days, most Israelis spoke Aramaic or even Greek later on, but not Hebrew. So I was wondering how you actually know what Hebrew sounded like in the original Psalms.
That's actually an acute question. First, you have to be careful. That is, in the later biblical period, say after the return from the Babylonian exile, this international Semitic language, Aramaic, which is, say, about as close to Hebrew as French is to Italian, came to be by stages the vernacular of the Jews of Palestine. And then with Alexander's conquest, the sophisticated part of the population fairly rapidly adopted Greek. But they also clung to Hebrew. They were very careful about the traditions of cantillation, of chanting the Hebrew texts of the Bible. I can't really guarantee that the way we pronounce Hebrew now based on the vowel points and punctuation put in beginning around the 6th century of the Christian era by a bunch of grammarians in Tiberias. I can't guarantee that that's exactly how it sounded back in the centuries right after David and Solomon. But I think that there is clearly a strong connection. And one way you can tell that is when you read it out loud in Hebrew, it has a lot of rhythmic integrity.
Thanks very much for that, Sam. Robert Alter, I guess, I'm curious about how you see, you now step into the on the path of many scholars before you, over thousands of years, who have translated these wonderful verses. And I wonder how you see what you've rendered here being used. You know, many people will be stuck on King James Version. After all, it came from a real wonderful period, practically Shakespeare's period of the English
right,
language.
That's right.
And here you have a book that could sit in pews in any synagogue or church, for that matter. Is that what you anticipate, or is this a scholar's work or something for the home? How do you see it?
Well, I really would hope, and this hope is based in part on feedback I've gotten from readers on my previous translations, that this would be used by a broad range of readers. Obviously, I'm aiming at people who love poetry, who may not necessarily be devout people, but who would like to be more closely in touch with the power and the music of the poetry of Psalms. But I think people who read the Psalms for devotional reasons, whether in a formal church or synagogue setting, or as a kind of private spiritual practice, I would hope would find that the immediacy of the poems comes across with a new freshness, so that as much as we all love the King James Version, that this might speak to people more directly.
Well, it speaks to me in a wonderful way. I love that directness. I'll put it right beside the King James Version, I guess, and it sort of depends what mood I'm in when I want to go to the Psalms.
I'll settle for that.
They're comforting in more than one way. I wish we had time for many more, but that's all we've got in this hour. Cantor Rosalie Tobus, thank you so much for bringing your beautiful voice to us today.
Thank you very much.
Cantor Rosalie Tobus of Temple Sinai in Brookline, Massachusetts, our great thanks to you. And Robert Alter, University of California, Berkeley, with your The Book of Psalms, a translation with commentary. It's been absolutely wonderful having you, and we thank you for being here.
Well, it's been a pleasure for me, and also a pleasure to hear Cantor Tobus' singing.
It was very nice hearing from you as well. Thank you.
We'll go out with a little Bono. This is U2's 40. Find the Psalms right here. You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I will sing a new song.